This is the Pop Medic Podcast for August 12th, 2015. Summer Challenge, Summer Schmallenge. Woohoo! Mm. Where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Amanda,
Mike,
and Jesse.
Wait, who's Jesse?
Special guest star.
Holy crap, it is Jesse. The last time he was here, he told me,
You are stupid.
That's all right.
Whoa, I missed this episode. Which episode in the vaults is this one?
That was April 2012 when we discussed Haruki Murakami's 1Q84. And then he also wanted Liz to confirm that I was stupid, which she did.
Oh, right.
Which she did, and neither of them have been back on the show since April 2012. Coincidentally. But Jesse is back today. Jesse, what have you been doing since April 2012?
I've just been locked in a closet somewhere. I got lost.
We finally let you go.
You janitors, they didn't know better.
No. We shoved Jeremy and Bill in that closet.
No, I've been traveling to different branches. I worked at Hermitage for a while, and now I work in the newly formed Public Technology Department.
Cool.
Here at the main library.
So you know how to work these microphones and stuff?
No.
Oh. You can make it sound better even though we're recording in an echoey conference room, right?
No.
Oh.
But I can help you fill out a job application.
Oh, okay.
Back to the closet.
So, yes, while you're here. As you can hear from the echo, we're actually not recording in a conference room. We're actually recording in the middle of the stage at the new Ascend Amphitheater.
Bring it!
All right.
So we just snuck on to the stage.
Yeah, talk fast.
Yeah, in the middle of the day.
We butted Rush into the inside.
There's still some sleeping fish fans on the lawn.
Ah, there you go.
I'm hoping that the fact that we're Metro employees like will count for something. If the police are called. We will be recording in impromptu locations around Nashville while the children's department at the main library is being remodeled. But back to the matter at hand. Last week's show, we said we were jocks and that we were going to crush some skulls.
That's right, nerd.
I said that?
Well, I said that.
Okay.
I said that.
I blacked out during
this. I gave Bill many Indian burns. That's why he's not here.
Hmm. So,
in library terms, that means that we blew our summer-wide summer challenge goal out of the water.
Woo-hoo.
1 million points.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. Fines are erased.
Oh.
So today we're going to take a victory lap and tell
we
you about our
champions.
That's totally fine that the fines are erased.
I knew I could get mine to sing
it.
Mike sings everywhere.
It's gotten a lot sillier in the past couple of years.
Yes, it's been a lot more fun since they added the mic ingredient to
the mic sing along every week.
Student.
We're going to tell you about our favorite books, movies, and music, and who knows what else we dived into during Summer Challenge. Jeremy is not here because he did not meet his summer challenge goal. Bill will be here, in fact, via satellite.
Worth more points.
Skyping in is worth points.
Uh-huh. It's a project. You can count it.
Apparently, I'm not the only person that doesn't like to read anymore because everyone decided to talk about books on the Summer Challenge episode.
I've corrupted you all. I love it.
Because apparently it's harder to write a book than watch a movie. Wait, did I say that? It's harder to read a book.
It's probably both.
It is harder to write a book than watch a movie, yes.
Yes, all true.
It is harder to read a book than watch a movie, apparently. So, Mike, what book did you read this summer?
Well, it was, dare I say, a challenge to whittle down books that I read during the summer, just to one to talk about today on the podcast. Should I chat about The Witcherly Woman by Ross MacDonald? I did quite enjoy it, but alas, I didn't think I could spend an entire review of it longer than It's Toast Noir-yo. Should I talk about comic book adaptation of Harlan Ellison's script for The City on the Edge of Forever, which is loaded with Easter eggs for Harlan Ellison fans? Ooh, exciting. But alas, I talked about a comic last week. Hey, I know, thought I, that on my very first podcast, I recommended Cloud Atlas, and as a kind of callback, I could recommend David Mitchell's latest book, The Bone Clocks, which I read way back in June. The Bone Clocks is basically a biography of a woman called Holly Sykes, told in multiple segments from the years 1984 to the year 2043. In 1984, she's a teenager who's run away from home because her boyfriend cheated on her, and since her mother told her that it was, like, totally gonna happen, she's, like, totally gonna show her by, like, running away.
It's, like, totally awesome, right?
Like, totally. Like, you know, she, like, is gonna listen to the Smiths, it's gonna be great, whatever. But along the way, she briefly works on an apple farm, meets some charming hippies, and is almost killed by a madman with telekinetic / necromantic powers, and is only saved by the ghost of a woman that she met earlier. And then it's back to some more apple picking.
So it's basically Cider House Rules.
Cider House Rules. I would totally read Cider House Rules if it had people who could lift dead people with their minds.
I was just going to say, define necromantic.
Raising the dead.
Okay.
Zombies.
I would say you're either a necromancer or you're not. There's no such thing as like necromantic.
The
like,
kind of necromantic.
Like I could make them people move their hands.
It's like, watch out, they're waving at you.
They kind of would, you know. The dead can nod, you know.
It would creep me out.
Yeah. I won't spoil it too much, but superpowered individuals crop up from time to time throughout the book, although most of the emphasis on the novel is not raising zombies, but just day-to-day living. Holly is only the main character of the first and last segments. The rest are told from other characters' points of view, which allow Mitchell to give different views on life on the modern age. For example, like in Cloud Atlas, there's a part where that is from the point of view of a snobby writer that is intended to be satirical of both modern writers and celebrity. But don't worry, genre fans, the supernatural in the books eventually crop up more frequently and get explained. Oh boy. Now this whole last part of this last paragraph of my review is very spoilery, so if you want to skip ahead. Skip ahead. The last segment is set in a post-apocalyptic future called the Endarkenment, where all oil has dried up and there is no power / internet. The Endarkenment had just set in a few years before this segment begins, and life has reverted back to an anarchic medieval free-for-all. Much like in Station 11, I believe that this entire segment was intended to comment on how everyone in our society is focused on the ephemerality of the internet, and most people don't really care anymore about, like, real stuff that used to be important, like being sociable with your neighbors, or local politics, or, you know, life outside a computer screen. But while Station 11 had a hopeful tone, almost like the fall of modern society was a good thing, the last part of the Bone Clocks is super-duper bleak. You know, not quite the road, but, you know.
Nothing's still, the road.
The road is just, you
know. Not quite Station 11 either, which kind of has a happy end.
Totally does. Anyway, and this part of the book, and not the bits with the super cool superpower people, will stick with me, and has cropped up in my mind quite frequently in the months since I've read it, and is why I'm recommending it today. So, while I stock up on guns and water and canned food, what have you got, Amanda?
Well, it's all fun and games till the internet goes down. So for me, it seems like when I was growing up, summer was kind of the big time for spring cleaning in our family. My mom was a school teacher, so was my dad. So for us, spring was really kind of more about survival. We were just focused on getting to the end of the school year, more so than, say, cleaning the basement. So once we finally did get to the freedom of June, my mom would attack our dusty, somewhat neglected house with a complete vengeance. Now, where I come from, the Amish community is really big, and so we would claim that we would work like the Amish to the point of even christening ourselves with Amish names. So my mom became Leah, dad was Levi, and I, of course, was Lizzie. Now, for some reason, my brother didn't.
I want to be Ephraim.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so, the role play.
Yes, actually, we committed.
I could churn butter like the best one.
I'm telling you. So for some reason, my brother never got a name, and I think it's because he was usually at basketball camp, because that was a priority for him, and we.
He probably thought it was because he was unloved.
I'm okay with that.
Fine, I guess.
I like being the favorite. You know.
Every time I make a jock joke, I feel bad because I know that your brother was a basketball star. I'm just like, oh, jeez.
He was still smart, though.
Oh, so I didn't know.
Okay.
Yeah, he went to Belmont to play basketball.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, D1. Yeah. Anyway, so it's funny because this past summer, Lizzie completely moved into my house. And I know that everyone always says, you become your mother, but I guess I didn't really expect it to happen quite this soon. I have too much stuff. I just want to admit that right from the get-go. I have way too much stuff. And I don't know, you guys are guys, so yeah, I don't know if you really feel like you have too much stuff or you even care.
Well, and it's starting the coincidence of it started to trim my 3,000 book collection recently, and it's been so hard. And then while coming through the boxes, it's like, you know, oh, look, it's my birth certificate. Oh, look, it's like the tickets to from Kill Bill from 10 years ago.
I just wondered,
it's been difficult.
Because my husband has like very little stuff. And I would say that our belongings are like split 90-10 in my favor, which helped that when he moved in with me, I didn't have to get rid of that much stuff. And I would also claim half of his 10% because it's usually stuff I made him buy, like clothes or shoes or, you know, underwear.
Do you live as like a monk in the woods?
He kind of, he does. I mean, his computer and that's about it. A computer and his phone and he's happy.
Take those books and burn them.
That's right. Books are dumb. So in order to combat the awesome accumulator that is me, I started reading a couple of like cleaning books, and I picked up that popular Japanese one about magically changing your life through tidying up.
That's super duper popular.
I have a feeling that the woman in that book, if she saw all my stuff, her head might explode into 1,000 neat and tidy little pieces.
Organized by size.
That's right, color. I read a couple other unremarkable books. I don't really remember. But the one that stuck with me was Seven, written by Jen Hatmaker. Now, Jen is the wife of Pastor Chris Hatmaker. They have a church in Austin, Texas. I think it's called New Church or New Austin Church. They have about 6 kids, which, you know, exponentially increases the amount of stuff that they have. And a few years ago, Jen just kind of got overwhelmed with it. So she decided to pick 7 categories where she could focus on 7 things, like food, clothing, spending, to really learn what was important in life and kind of find out what was just background noise. And it was a tough challenge. Some months the kids would join in, like with the giving month or the spending month, but then other months she let them kind of sit out, like with clothes. Because imagine going to school with only 3 shirts, 1 pair of pants, some boots, because it was Texas, a hoodie, and a jacket. Now, she did not count underwear, and I think we're all a little bit better because of that, because that would get scary after a month. And her insights during those months were insightful. My only complaint is that her changes weren't really permanent. Each experiment lasted for a month, and then she kind of went back to her old life, hopefully a little bit wiser and a little bit more mindful of the excess in our society. If you'd like to read a little bit more about these options, my good friend Lori wrote a great review of several organizing books on our off-the-shelf blog. Now, personally, I was really looking for more of a simplification system that would help me not accumulate so much stuff. And kind of as a side note, I've since discovered that if you cut up your credit cards, it's very helpful to not get a lot of junk you don't need. So with the help of Jen and a Japanese lady, I attacked my house and ended up giving away about 8 bags of clothes to the thrift store at my parents' church. And even my husband contributed about 3 or 4 things, or approximately 37% of his net wardrobe. That's how I do math. And this was my favorite part of the summer challenge. And for cleaning out and reorganizing all of my closets alone, I earned 90 gazillion bajillion points. Now, if you give Amanda a book, she'll be happy for a day. But if you give Amanda a book about cleaning her closets, her husband might actually be able to find both pairs of his shoes. All right, Mr. Jesse. All
right, so the first points that I earned for the summer challenge were help someone and make something when I inadvertently helped the person make a fake ID at the desk.
Wow, things you learned.
Full service library.
Yeah. Administrators just told me in my earpiece that I should emphasize that you inadvertently did that.
Inadvertently.
Yes, inadvertently.
He said, hold this while I cut it. And then I realized as I was holding it that it was a photocopied driver's license. So, hopefully this fake ID won't work. But the majority of the points that I earned were that you get 20 points for reading for 20 minutes. And I probably earned the majority of my points reading a challenging book, I Am Radar by Reef Larson. Which was a pretty huge book, like 600 or 700 pages, which it felt huge. It was extra heavy, the paper they printed it on, so it seemed bigger. But it was a really good book. It got a lot of comparisons to Thomas Pynchon and David Foster Wallace, which immediately piqued my interest. Though I think that
I remember. You told me I was stupid because I didn't like David Foster Wallace. I remember now.
The stupid, but you couldn't remember the context.
I knew the context.
I just thought I was stupid because I had a low IQ, but you...
No.
This is really like... We should have a little
bit of previous episode. Mikey had to step out.
Have a discussion, you know?
But anyway, so that immediately piqued my interest. The comparisons to those writers. And I think he more earns the comparisons in theme than style. It's not stylistically very Pynchon-esque or David Foster Wallace-y. There's a few references, like direct references to Pynchon. There's a character who gets a post-horn tattoo at one point in the book. But basically, the book follows the history of this avant-garde science-based puppet troupe from Norway. And it's one of those where you read a book sometimes and you're like, oh, I wonder what that character's backstory is, but you don't get much. Well, Reef Larsen, that's what the book is basically you get a character and then an entire, like, 300 pages of that sort of minor character's backstory, which I kind of enjoyed. So you go take this Norwegian puppet troupe, but you get, you know, Cambodian history from the early 20th century through the Vietnam War. You get a long time spent in the Serbian civil wars of the early 90s, and then a lot of New York and New Jersey in the late 60s. There's a great character who is a librarian who ends up destroying a library.
Yes!
There's some visceral sort of vicarious
traitor
fun through that.
Burn it down!
But it's a very sprawling, not always very focused book, and the end sort of is lackluster, but it's kind of, you know, it's one of those works that you absorb. And I think I'm sort of on record through various reviews that I've given that I don't care about endings very much. And this is another book where the ending just kind of happens, which is kind of nice because that's the way the world works, right?
You might have to have a conversation with Mike because I think Mike is big on an ending. I think Amanda too likes a good
ending. I'm going to read a whole bunch of books that better have a good ending.
I'm kind of with you. For the experience. I'm just here breathing.
It ends on a very beautiful image, which maybe plot-wise is unsatisfying, but artistically works really well for me. And I really enjoyed the book, and I recommend to people who... And I think if you like David Foster Wallace and Thomas Pynchon, even though it's not exactly the same, I think that's a good hallmark for jumping off point for people.
I did really enjoy The Pale King. I want to say, too, you know, I've been sort of busting your chops since you're back, but I've actually said on the podcast, I wish Jesse was back because I wish I had like a literature ally.
Yeah.
But, you know.
There has been mocking.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes.
Sorry.
So I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you're talking about some pretentious literary book.
Good.
Makes me feel good.
I don't really think you're stupid. I just think that one opinion you have is stupid.
Wow.
We're going to hug it out later.
That's very love the sinner, hate the sin kind of thing.
I feel like I've walked in some sort of sequel to something I was unprepared for and didn't know about.
You need to go back and listen to April 2012 and clear it all up for you.
Oh, yeah.
Before. That was a fun episode. Lisa
I liked that episode. That
and
was a good
Liz
episode.
Were on that episode.
I liked that book, too. Like, I didn't think I would because it was really long, but I did like it.
Again, that was 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami.
And it's sort of an unsatisfying end.
It kind of did, yeah, a little bit.
All his books kind of do.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily too. What's the one about the unicorn skulls?
You know, the one with the unicorn skulls.
I don't know. The producer will correct it. That would be Hard Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World. The producer. Speaking of producers, let's see if I can hack into some computer networks and get Bill on the line. Bill, what was your favorite book during Summer Challenge?
My best of Summer Challenge. Well, first, let me back up. I was going to my local cinema. I became intrigued by a preview of a coming attraction of a movie called Z for Zachariah. In doing some research, it's based on a book called Z for Zachariah by Robert C. O'Brien. I checked the book out and I really enjoyed it. It deals with a 16-year-old girl named Ann Burden, sole survivor, who is living in this valley untouched by a nuclear war. The book is told from the 16-year-old's point of view. The book is written in the form of a journal, and one day Anne sees a campfire smoke, and someone's coming, a stranger. The stranger's name is John Loomis. When Mr. Loomis comes to town, that's when the cat and mouse story start. Z for Zachariah is a suspenseful page-turner. Please read it before the summer's gone. In doing research, this was the final book by Robert C. O'Brien, who is famous for the children's classic Miss Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. Z for Zachariah was meant to be an adult novel, however it's considered to be a young adult novel. But that should not keep you from reading this uncompromising page-turner. Interesting, the book was uncompleted when Mr. O'Brien died, so his wife and daughter finished it using his notes. Once again, the title of the book, Z for Zachariah, by Robert C. O'Brien.
Thanks, Bill.
Wow.
How enlightening.
That book sounded amazing.
I'd read that book. Actually, I can't say it's a genre, so actually I probably wouldn't read that book.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
But
genre snob.
So what I wanted to talk about today was actually something that I did talk about before, but I wanted to revisit it because it keeps bringing me so much joy. But before I get to that, I want to go back and talk about the things that I said I was going to do for Summer Challenge and see how much progress I made. So one of the things was I was going to create a library box, like a free portable, like open source file server. I didn't do that. Because you recall, I actually had to like buy the parts for that, and that's why I didn't do that. So the other thing was like I was going to get my Raspberry Pi up and running again, either as a Tor node or as a media center. Tor node, that actually would take work, and I could do that, but I never sat down to do it. Now, media center, sorta. I got my Raspberry Pi hooked up, updated the software, it still works, but I don't have my computers networked at all. But it can play files that, you know, the rest of my junk won't play, like it'll, because it's awesome and open source, it'll just play like open files. I mean, it'll play just any file format in the world, as opposed to like commercial hardware that's like will only play like crappy proprietary formats. So,
and if you're interested, listeners, we have many books on Raspberry Pi now. I never even heard of it till Brian mentioned it, and now we've got like a couple.
I think, you know,
a couple, one or two, folks. Get your
we've got that
in
Arduino, whatever. We have a crap ton of books on that thing. I don't even know what it is.
The microprocessor.
Apparently, that's where I keep shoving it. So.
Yay, I picked the right number. Yay.
Yeah, I think I put it. Well, yeah, it could be robotics. I forget. Anyway.
There's a lot of applications.
Sure.
See, he's on the tech team, so he knows stuff like that.
Oh.
He's here to translate for us book people
yeah.
all this tech stuff. Yeah. So anyway, so I sort of did one of the things I said I was going to do. Maybe I'll report back later. But the thing that I kept coming back to that kept bringing me so much joy was the opera Tomorrow in a Year by The Knife, Planning to Rock, and Mount Sims. Now, I talked about this on our opera episode. That was October 15th, 2015. And actually, if you want to go back and listen to an episode...
It wasn't October 2015.
I was going to say, wait. Live from the future.
In episode correction?
Was the host inarticulate? Maybe we need a new host. So go back October 15th, 2014. Okay. Why Not Opera? That was a fun episode because basically we fight with each other a lot.
I won, by the way.
I think
you did.
Well, let's not spoil it as to why you won. Yeah, I remember, but okay, yes. Amanda won.
That's kind of fun. I think this October I'll watch Rocky Horror Picture Show that we could have another
I've never seen that. So.
Yeah.
So you know, like a lot of people nowadays on my phone, I just have a bunch of songs, and I'm not a streamer. I think that wastes energy and data. I still like to actually put files on my phone, and I think this is totally probably an egotistical illusion that I'm very good at creating like meta mixes of like say like 4 gigs of music and then putting it on random and having that like whatever I chose work no matter what song comes up. And of course there's songs I pick, so how could I go wrong, right? But there were tracks keep coming up. It's like, oh, I gotta listen to that again. It was just like really blowing my mind, and then I realized they were all songs off Tomorrow in a Year. So then I went back like, oh, I gotta like dig deeper into this, and I did, and I realized that this quote-unquote opera written by 3 different techno producers was actually a proper opera that worked like an opera, that worked the way music is supposed to, and had themes that reoccurred and dramatic arc, and it was really just amazing. And that's just some background that I didn't talk about before. So it is about Charles Darwin and about his work and about his book Origin of the Species, and then also his biography. So for some of the recordings, Olaf Dreyer, one of the members of The Knife, actually went to Brazil to record birds and learn how to do field recordings. And then those field recordings and the bird noises they actually used, but then they also mimic those sounds electronically. So there's those actual sounds, and then electronic versions of those sounds are all worked in to the music. And then of course there's normal music too, with like, you know, notes and melody and rhythms and things like that. But it all works together really great. And then they also apply genetic theory to structure some of the music. And I think that it really works. And where this all really comes together is like one track is kind of like the big penultimate piece is The Color of Pigeons, and it literally is this long operatic piece with three different singers about the color of pigeons. It's amazing. So singing on this track are Jonathan Johansson, a Swedish pop star, Larka Winther, who's a Swedish actress, and Christina Whalen, a mezzo-soprano who I talked about on the opera episode before. They all sing. It's so beautiful. And, you know, I never found Charles Darwin like an inspiring figure. I'm just not one of those people that gets excited about actual science books. Like, I think I understand the genius of, I think I do anyway. I am stupid. I mean, I think I understand the genius of Einstein, Copernicus, and Charles Darwin, but, like, I don't read The Revolution of the Planets or whatever it is by Copernicus, or, like, I never read Einstein's physics papers. It's like, wow.
I don't only know, like, two words in those physics papers.
Yeah, so like, I've never, like...
MC squared.
I've never read The Origin of the Species, like, as a work that, you know, would inspire me the way that, you know, like, artists would inspire me. But maybe I'm just a humanities flunk out,
I feel like,
right?
Darwin's a lister, too. Like, if you want to read a lot of lists... I haven't read it either, but...
So I never thought a song about a list of the color of pigeons would move me, but it totally does. And I was even put off by this record when I heard, because, like, Charles Darwin doesn't inspire me. But the last time Jesse was here, or not the last time, but when Jesse was on the podcast before, in one of these episodes, he talked about how his experience with Otis Redding was actually like a spiritual experience. The human voice is one of the ways that music can be spiritual, or just like move you in your soul as much as possible. And I think when people who are into opera, or an opera works the way it's supposed to, I think that's what happens. I've had that experience listening to the song, The Color of Pigeons. I just never thought that that would move me in that way spiritually. So just amazing. And, you know, what's funny too is usually on the podcast, I'm sort of the enfant terrible when it comes to music samples. I just like to drop noise sometimes on people, though I think Mike might be taking that role over for me. You know, but there are a lot of like really beautiful songs in this opera. And one of those songs is The Height of Summer, which closes the show. Library nerd things that fascinates me too. These are these electronic music producers who put out pop records, but now because this is called an opera, all of a sudden it's an art song instead of just a song, and those sort of ideological distinctions and how they fit in the symbolic order, that's all fascinating to me. And kind of related to that, again, Olaf Dreyer said when they were first asked to write this opera, he was like, I don't know anything about opera at all. And he's like, one of the reasons why they did it was like, well, it's a challenge. Like, we don't know anything about opera. We've been asked to write an opera. We need to do that. And that was actually the theme of their last record before they broke up. The Knife's last record before they broke up was Shaking the Habitual, all about trying to like sort of get yourself out of your comfort zone. So he actually said it took him a year before he was moved by an opera singer. Like, emotionally, he could figure out, like, how to write music that would work the same way. I just thought that was really interesting. And, well, I got to tell you, man, you did it. Olaf, Karen, Planning to Rock, Mount Sims, you made an awesome opera that's just been totally on repeat that I keep going back to for a year. So I love it.
Sounds very thematically similar to what's going on in the book that I was talking about, I Am Radar. It's like puppet shows about particle physics. So I don't know, like, it seems thematically like they're coming from a similar place. And sometimes in the book, the art that they're talking about doesn't always make sense, but it sounds like this is, like, a tangible form of that. Like, it actually, you talking about that makes the book make a little more sense for me.
I think that's kind of become the new genre. Like, we talked about the Adams opera that's about the atomic bomb. I mean, mm-hmm. Like, you take these big... scientific events, and then you make them into an art form.
The intersection of art and science. Mm-hmm.
Hey guys.
Hey.
What's
tickling our fancy?
That was it.
What, What's either the thing that fancy this week?
Either
maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't.
Either way,
it's tickling our fancy this week.
Jesse? Bill? Oh, Bill. Sorry.
Bill?
Bill?
Via, what, how did I say it was getting?
On location?
Skype? Bill, on Skype?
Tickling my fancy are the Courtyard Concerts. Starting Tuesday, August 11th at 11:45, you can see the musical group Riders in the Sky. And for the following Tuesdays till October 6th, you can see a concert for free. Acts ranging from Jerry Douglas and Friends, the Wanna Beatles, among others. So come this Tuesday, starting August 11th, to the Downtown Public Library for the Courtyard Concerts.
Obviously, August 11th was yesterday, but there are many Courtyard Concerts to go. Gee, thanks, Bill.
That was fun.
Everyone loves the Courtyard Concerts. We get phone calls in March. Like,
there are people on my bus who are like, you know, Mike, you're a librarian. Yeah, yeah. When are the Courtyard Concerts coming back, Mike?
Get your parking now.
Nothing about books or movies or anything. It's like Courtyard Concerts, man.
Riders in the Sky, kinda, baby.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, good stuff. Ooh.
Courtyard Concerts are back. Everyone just chill out and be happy. Jesse, what's tickling your fancy this week?
So I just binge-watched the second season of BoJack Horseman on Netflix, which is amazing. It's such a good show. It's, like, everything that you expect is going to happen. It's really inverts your expectations. It's a different show than what it looks like it would be. But what's tickling my fancy is in the very last scene of the show, there's a song by Courtney Barnett called Avant Gardener that we have available on Freegal. We have two albums by her on Freegal. And I had heard the song like a year ago on Lightning 100. And of course, every song that I like on Lightning 100, they never play ever again. They're just like, oh, look, here's a cool rock song. And then here's, you know,
now let's play
another year of adult contemporary Americana. But so I'd heard the song and I really liked it and then had forgotten about it. And then heard it in BoJack Horseman. Found out we have everything that she's ever recorded available on Freegal. There's a double EP called Sea of Split Peas. It's called The Double EP, colon, The Sea of Split Peas. And then a record called Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit. Both of which are...
Oh, yeah!
Yeah. Both of which are really good. It's kind of... it makes me think of like a band that could have been on Kill Rock Stars or K Records in the early 90s. Like that kind of like Pacific Northwest indie rock... It's very wordy.
I'm throwing a snob card for you.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
Thanks.
Ooh. Oh.
Thanks.
But
it's really good. I really like it. It's very catchy, and I just want to listen to that one Avant Gardener. I want to listen to that song over and over again all the time right now. Who else is being tickled?
I'm tickled. So for the regular segment, I talked about, you know, the book 7 by Jen Hatmaker. So the book that that's tickling my fancy today is because of 7. And unfortunately, the National Public Library does not have a copy, but I got it through interlibrary loan, and I was not disappointed. So the 7th challenge of Jen's 7 book was called 7 Sacred Pauses, which I think kind of works out a little bit like being the 7th son of the 7th son. And at one point in her book, Jen makes the comment, I wish I could just quote the whole book. Now, since I'd been enjoying that section so far, I thought, well, then why don't I read the whole book? It is written by Macrina, I can't say her last name, Weidecker, and it's called 7 Sacred Pauses, and it is a marvelously quotable book. I think most people have heard of Vespers, which are evening prayers, because most abbeys and churches observe that much on a daily basis. There are actually 7 different daily prayers where you can pause and reflect throughout the day. Weidecker is a member of a Benedictine order, and she lives in a monastery in Texas where they usually participate in all 7 prayers. I can't remember if they do all 7 every day, but they have a very strong habit of observing at least some of them.
Wrong habit. Mike's rubbing off on
me. I didn't even plan that. That's just genius right there.
None of those thoughts came to mind for me.
So the prayers start at midnight with vigils or night watch, then prayers at dawn, and then followed by prayers at mid-morning and noon. There's an afternoon prayer followed by Vespers, which I mentioned, and then the final compline or night prayer. Vitrecure's book has sections with readings or scripture for each prayer, followed by favorite quotes to use as antiphons, which are repeatable lines of text on which you can meditate. The author is a Christian, but she also pulls inspiration from other religious texts and authors, including the Bhagavad Gita and Emily Dickinson. Her goal is to combine religions and focus more on the good aspects of them as opposed to the neener neener of the whole my religion is better than your religion crowd. She also has written quite a bit of beautiful poetry to accompany her meditations. Now, personally, I've not tried to experience the seven sacred pauses. I don't really have any desire to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to pray. But I really enjoyed reading about them, and as I was going through it, the book just seemed very peaceful and serene. So if your life is a little bit hectic, you might want to check this one out and find a different way to simplify your world. Mike?
Well, today it was a toss-up between two other books that I could have mentioned for a summer challenge, but alas, I could not find any information in a hurry about Attack of the Fluffy Bunnies, so that will have to come later. So today, I'm going to talk about Orson Welles' last movie, The Making of the Other Side of the Wind by Josh Karp. It's pretty cool. It's a very, you know, readable and fun. Orson Welles in the late 60s was tired of, like, working in bad commercials and just taking, like, you know, bits parts for hire. So he wanted to make, like, one movie about a washed-up director who just came back from Europe who wants to make one last movie as a comeback. Kind of autobiographical. It took him about 6 years to finally, like, film everything. I mean, he got, John Huston to play the director guy. You know, it's got the guy who played Commissioner Gordon, I think, in the Batman TV series. it's got, like, Rich Little. And it sounds like a pretty cool movie. And he filmed it all and started editing. And then, not enough funding to actually finish the editing. And it's been sitting in a vault since the late 70s. And, you know, it's even got bits that are tied in with the Iranian Revolution because some of the backers were Iranians, like the Shah of Iran was trying to, like, make the country look good. So he thought he invested in American movies. And then suddenly the Shah got deposed. And as a kind of follow-up, which will probably be in the paperback, there was a recent Indiegogo campaign to complete the editing that itself did not get funded because this movie is cursed. And the whoever put up the Indiegogo says that they've got a mysterious backer who's going to, like, you know, throw in all the money and it'll actually get finished. So who knows?
But who's going to actually do the editing, though?
Peter Bogdanovich, least according to the book.
Okay, cool, I win.
Yeah. Yeah, at least according to the book, Orson Welles took him aside once and was like, "You know, Peter, if I can't finish this, then you can." And Bogdanovich is like, "What do you mean, Orson? I guess I will, whatever, you know." But it was one of those kind of things where it sounds like something Bogdanovich said that maybe or maybe not. And it's a pretty cool parallel of Bogdanovich's, like, filmmaking in the 70s, how, like, you know, he started with, like, The Last Picture Show and, like, how he too, like, had a critical darling and then kind of went downhill after that. Much like his mentor as well, so, like, you know, fun stuff. What do we got, Brian?
So, tickling my fancy this week is a book. This is a very bookish episode. My book club is reading a book called A Summons to Memphis by Peter Taylor, which some would argue is a Nashville classic, Southern classic. I think a good book club should always get you out of your comfort zone and challenge you to read different things, and mine definitely does that. Probably wouldn't read this book on my own. I am a Yankee transplant that doesn't deserve to live here. So
Yankees, eh?
So
this is the same problem.
You guys and your, like, hatred of sweet tea and grits.
I really do. So 0-2.
If you haven't noticed already, I'm just going to bring it in this book review about a summon to Memphis. So it's about this wealthy Nashville family who gets totally upended when they have to move from Nashville to Memphis and the drama that causes in their life. And this takes place in the 1930s. It's crazy old South racist, and I think the fact that they act like we're just normal everyday people and people hold books like this up as great works of literature only perpetuates racism. I think that should be noted. And the other kind of books that I really hate are just like rich people complaining about they don't get to marry who they want. There's a certain type of...
Ah, jeez, I get so...
I'm just like, I just do not care, you know, have enough balls to tell your grumpy father to go suck an egg. So this
get a job.
But you can take all my money away and I'll have to work like the plebeian.
So this book is some weird like nest of evil that little chicks of bad ideas sort of pop out of in their mind. And,
I might read it just for that.
But I am going to say Peter Taylor really, really knows how to write a sentence. And not only that, but he learned how to write a sentence before Ernest Hemingway. So it's like really like old world and the sort of like snobby private schools that he used to ride a pony to in the book. literally. You know, like taught him well and how to write differently, and someone who appreciates prose. It really has been an interesting experience. And also, it's just, like I said, I'm a transplant. It's just filled with all this Nashville culture and also a lot of classism, too, because the whole idea is that Memphis is low, but Nashville is high, right? I get it, right? Okay. So there's all this kind of snobbery in there. But the really good writing and all this local history that is of interest to me, but with all these other things that I think are negative, like it's this bizarro experience. It's like taking a really powerful drug and you're not sure if you like it or not. So it's been very interesting. It is tickling my fancy, A Summons to Memphis by Peter Taylor. We will be discussing this in the Second Wednesday Book Club today, if you listen to this before noon on Wednesday, August 12th.
So you've got 4 hours to read an entire book.
Yes.
And show up.
I mean, I don't know. I read slow. Said Jen Jensen was the author of The Green River Killer. It was Jeff Jensen.
That's pretty close.
Jeremy also demanded that I tell you that he was the Entertainment Weekly Lost columnist when Lost was on the air, and Jeremy and Crystal both said that that column was essential to appreciating the show.
Oh, that Jeff Jensen was the columnist.
Yeah, I was about to say, so Jeremy was the Entertainment Weekly columnist?
Like, I know he's writing, but
I didn't know that, you know, he's working in the library when he's such a famous EW columnist.
Was our host inarticulate?
Never.
Me no no.
Jeff Jensen, author of The Green River Killer, was the Lost Entertainment Weekly columnist when Lost was on the air. The Meat Puppets have another album on Hoopla, Golden Lies, not just their, you know, contemporary classic, Too High to Die. Those are the only corrections that I had.
I think I said, what's up, Deutschland? Really, it's, what are you doing, Deutschland, or something like that? Oh, well. Cameo DM's first CD is not very good. Oh, burn. Oh, yes.
You burn yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So not a correction,
but... What do you know, Deutschland?
Ha! You're right, I think that's what it is. Yeah. Not a correction, but an addendum. Of course, I used a small sample of Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2, at the beginning of last week's school-themed episode. For more information about Pink Floyd and drugs...
Floydy Pink.
You can go to...
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week, we look to the stars.
Oh, a star is born. We'll be right back.
You know, this might get cut, but like one of the interesting things about the color of pigeons is it's not just the thing about the thing that Darwin wrote about the color of pigeons. So mixed into it, even though it's like sort of like poetry, so it's like the themes are kind of like mixed up. It's not like this clear narrative, but it's about how Darwin goes away, observes all these other birds, gets all this other knowledge, and then comes back, looks at his pigeons in England, and then he has all these other insights about his pigeons. So it's actually about going out, getting human experiences, getting new knowledge, and then coming back home and seeing things in a different way. Mm-hmm. So like this life experience, and it's right. I think that's also why it's kind of like the centerpiece of this one piece of music is kind of the centerpiece of the opera, because it's also about how his ideas changed the world, you know, after he went out and made these observations. Never thought I would care. It's so good.
One of the things worked that way, though.
Is it on Freegal?
We have it on CD. And then we also have all of, or most of the Knife's discography is on Hoopla.
You've inspired me to go seek it out.
You probably hate it,
sorry. Oh, wow. You can come back in 3 years and tell about how much you didn't like it.
If I don't like it, I will let you know how stupid you are.
I am just used to like making these sort of very passionate rhetorical pitches for like difficult art that I like, and then having like normally these guys be like, dude, that was terrible.
Yeah,
I don't mean to bring you down.
I hate to say it, but an entire song about pigeon colors doesn't really excite me. But you know.
It's not a long song. It's like, it's gray.
It's gray. It's slightly less gray than the one before that.
A little
more gray.
Kind of gray.
Kind of gray this time. I'm not sure. Did I mention gray?
I think they're calling you stupid.
You just do it.
Yeah, it's all good. I have, the thing about stupid people is that, like, they just plow ahead, you know. You
can, are we great?
They don't like we stupid people. It's like smart people who can be slighted. Like stupid people, just like they're like a train and they're just kind of like, okay, I'm going.
I think I can.
Exactly. So it's all right.